I issued my first catalog as a rare book dealer in the autumn of 1982 while still teaching at Warwick. It was printed on glossy paper with illustrations, which was uncommon at the time, and in my naivety, I thought it rather grand. But when my worldly printer handed over the first copy, he looked at it fondly, if not admiringly. "Not bad," he said, "cheap and cheerful." I wished my father, who'd died 2 years earlier, had been there at that moment to see it. He would have been ever so proud. On my visits home over the last few years of his life, he'd become fascinated by my new vocation as a book scout, and he would sit in his Eames chair, put his Record of the Magic Flute on his new Danish teak modern hi-fi, and quiz me about book values. "First edition of Brighton Rock," he'd ask. "Ooh," I'd say, "one of the scarcer ones, especially in dust wrapper. I'd pay $500 if I could find one, if you'd lend me the money." He would have. He was uncommonly engaged with this new incarnation of mine. No one in our family had ever been good at business, and my combination of literary and financial acumen fascinated him. I would come home from New York City after a day scouting for rare books with a few $100 of profit in my pocket, and we would both be lost in admiration. We contemplated setting up a business together, Sun and Joukowsky, Rare Books. I wish this name might have been on my new catalog, but I liked it anyway, whatever it was. I loved it. I took that first copy home, made myself a cup of coffee, and sat at our pine dining table in the kitchen, leafing through it happily. I was shortly joined by our neighbor, the rather strict academic wife of one of my colleagues. I should have known better, but I was so chuffed with my little green catalog that I handed it over excitedly, saying, "Look, my first catalog." She flipped through it in a desultory way, taking in the occasional details, but mostly, so far as I could see, of the prices. She paused for a moment and looked me squarely in the eye, as anyone fearlessly committed to the telling of truths should do. "How disgusting," she said. I don't recall how I responded. I'm not sure I said anything at all. I was aware, of course, that academics are hostile to trade as well as ignorant about it. And though happy to deploy this prejudice, she would also have known that much of the material she'd worked on as a graduate student, rare texts, letters, and manuscripts by writers, would have found its way into the Special Collections Department of Libraries through the rare book trade. I don't know, it may be that rare book dealers like rubbish men are necessary, but that doesn't make them smell good. The problem was compounded by the fact that I'd gone into business in rare books. Books, to my academic colleagues, indeed, books to most sane people, are objects of utility, designed to convey information and to give pleasure, and esteemed accordingly. To value a book not for what is in it, but as it were for itself or in itself, suggests a fetishization of the object that many people in the academic and literary worlds find both incomprehensible and offensive. From that time, colleagues would occasionally inquire sniffily, "And how is business?" My regular response to this, "Terrific, and how are you finding academic life?" generally signaled an end to the conversation and a confirmation of the distance that now separated us. When I gave up teaching in 1984, the major emotion that accompanied my retreat from university life was anger. I was rather surprised by this. I kept banging on about my feelings obsessively, like someone with post-traumatic stress syndrome. I bored myself, I bored everybody. Though I was ostensibly having a terrific time in my new career as a rare book dealer, I could neither purge the regret I felt at having wasted my time and my energy, nor give up the social cachet of being a university teacher. In order to purge this anger and to eradicate the hold that university teaching still had on me, I conceived a cunning plan, which I hoped would rid me of the toxicity of my academic persona, the fearfulness, the hyper-skepticism, the pomposity, the anxiety not to be found out for the drudge that I was. I called this new activity and this new project Becoming Less Intelligent. It was fun. I hardly needed to cultivate my Philistinism because it was pretty full-grown already. I've always preferred sport to high art and have a positive dislike for people who regard themselves as cultured. Next time you go to the opera, look at the body language of most of the patrons, the stiffness of demeanor, the noses held that extra 10 degrees skywards, the strangulated voices. There is little so repellent to me as the English in high culture mode. Nor did it take much for me to give up going to the theater, which I've always disliked, all that spitting and declaiming, the audience's anxiety that something might go wrong allied to the vague hope that it might. I abjured philosophy, that was easy enough, but I also swore off literature. No more fancy reading, no more highbrow talking, simplify, if not to refine, then even to coarsen, become less intelligent. I confined my TV watching to sports and movies and my reading to detective fiction. I gorged myself. I grew fat and indolent with reading thrillers. I read dozens of thriller writers and hundreds of books, like Kingsley Amis, who complained that he was quickly bored by a novel that didn't begin with the words, "A shot rang out." I demanded nothing but finger-on-the-trigger entertainment. In the Hampstead branch of Waterston's one day, I spotted a book called Double Whammy by an author unknown to me. I hardly gave it a thought until I read the puff on the front cover, which read, "Better than literature, P.J. O'Rourke." Perfect. Something other than literature was what I was looking for, and something better than literature was a bonus. And anything that P.J. O'Rourke is that keen on is okay with me. He may be laughably right-wing, but he's funny and he's sharp as a tack. And I reckon that this Carl Hiaasen, which was the author's name, must be worth reading. He was. His novels were blackly comic, with a one-eyed protagonist called Clinton Tyree, who is a dropout governor of California who becomes a hermit in the Everglades under the name of Skink and lives on roadkill. There was a cast of characters ranging from the wacky to the totally deranged, and the writing was wonderful, totally surprising in tone and content, and it made me cringe and howl with laughter and contract in righteous indignation. The novel culminated in a scene in which a psychopath who's been bitten on the arm by a rabid dog and is unable to prise its jaws open even when it's dead simply cuts off its body and goes about his business with the dead dog's head attached to his arm. Fabulous. But there is something more than sheer mayhem going on. Skink is a great comic creation, but his story is a black parable of the fall. He enters politics naively in order to do good, and he's brought down by the massed forces of greed and corruption that are endemic to South Florida. Entrusted with a veritable Garden of Eden, a virgin territory, he presides over its destruction. His withdrawal into the swamps is like an act of penance. He says, "Do you want to know who I am? I'm the guy who had a chance to save this place. Only I blew it." I enjoyed the novel so much, I loved it so much, that I did something I've never done before or after. I went to the excellent local bookshop in Primrose Hill, and I ordered 10 copies just to give away to my friends. My kids each got one, the guys in my office, various chums of one sort or another. I gave Salman Rushdie one. He'd never heard of Carl Hiaasen. And in exchange for the tip, he insisted I read Stephen King. Stephen King? What an odd notion. He's terrific, Salman said. And he was right. This Carl Hiaasen was clearly serious, but he wasn't high serious. He was low serious. I preferred that, and it set a sort of example. He seemed to be having fun writing, and all of a sudden I was having fun reading. It had all the freshness of a new experience. Was there something frivolous about the way he wrote and about the way I read him? Yeah, absolutely, though by no means entirely. And that's what I had yearned for and what I'd been missing in making reading into my profession. And yes, I'm perfectly aware that people don't have fun in their professions. Do accountants adore all that yummy adding up, or do lawyers love all that obsessional prevaricating? No, most of the ones I know come to dislike it, as I came to dislike the profession of letters. Literature, as taught at universities, has become an institution, syllabus-bound, examination-driven. You get marks for how well you understand Dickens. I gave them. I'd become institutionalized, too. I'd been trained by teachers who believed that the study of literature is good for you, that it deepens and it widens sensibility, it's morally improving. It should thus follow that proper students of literature are the best and the wisest of persons. Yet I have scanned myself in vain for traces of wisdom and exceptional goodness, and wondered whether my former colleagues exhibited these qualities. On these very grounds, V.S. Naipaul has recently suggested that English should no longer be offered as a university subject, and all English departments should be disbanded. He says, I think it would be a great fillip, a great boost to the intellectual life of the country. It would release a lot of manpower. They could go to work on the buses and things like that. I sometimes argued similarly to my colleagues that the study of literature, if it's to be enjoyable as well as serious, would better take place in forums like reading groups or adult education courses. Had Sir Vidya gone on to say that teaching in an English department is positively bad for you, I think I would have agreed with him. It had stiffened my emotional and intellectual sinews, drained my reservoirs of delight, made me even more pompous and domineering. Becoming less intelligent was an attempt at reforming myself, and I suppose it had to begin with deforming what had preceded. Detoxifying, I called it, and there was nothing pretty about the process. One afternoon, playing golf with a good friend, I hit my drive into a lake. I teed up another ball, and I hit that into the lake as well, and then I teed up another and scuffed it along the ground into a bush. Fuck, I screamed, fucking fuck. I took my driver and I flung it down the hill, and it turned in an ungainly parabola and landed next to the bush where the ball lay. My chum looked at me disapprovingly. He had no objection whatsoever to foul language, but throwing golf clubs was definitely bad behavior. You know this project of yours, becoming less intelligent, he said tartly. What? I started walking down the hill. You don't talk to a man who's lying five in a bush 40 yards from a tee. It's neither polite nor safe. You could be taking it too far, he said. And he was right. You can't deny who you are. What I had read defined me, informed my judgments, influenced every moment of who I was and what I did. It's all very well. Become less pompous. Be less intelligent. But you can't live by Carl Hiaasen alone. If he is funnier and more enjoyable to read and more passionately committed than many of our syllabuses, canonic authors, he isn't as good a writer. And there's something to be said, after all, for literature. When I was teaching at Warwick, we used to interview all prospective students. I gather they no longer have the time or energy to do so. And in answer to my question, tell me why you want to read English, I would often get some variety of the answer, because I'm very interested in people and in how they work. Oh, why in that case, I would ask, don't you read psychology? That's what that's about. Or history, or philosophy, or, God forbid, sociology. Reading English is for people who care about literature, not about the truths that literature may reveal, the paraphrases, the meanings, but literature itself. And I still feel this passionately. We have to preserve some area in which literary language and form and tonality are foregrounded to preserve the practices and the virtues of close reading. It took me a while to reach this position, and when I did, I was no longer angry, nor indeed so dismissive of my former incarnation as a university teacher. I believed I had transcended literature with the help of Carl Hiaasen, but what a lovely irony this is. It seems to me that I was wrong, or at least that my concept of literature needed refining, not my concept of intelligence. In 1999, the redoubtable literary partnership of Colm Toybean and Carmen Khalil published a book called The Modern Library, The 200 Best Novels in English Since 1950. They included Carl Hiaasen's Double Whammy.